and welcome back to That's What She Said, the intersectional feminist podcast bringing you current news and, as always, a badass woman from history. With me, Hannah Thacker.
And me, Nina Attridge.
Hello.
Hi, I was just clogging some wine as I said my name. And I was like, okay, right, that's me, that's my cue. Oh, God. It's horrible.
That's all they expect from us, really.
Yeah, I know. So. I was like,
it's a new year, Nina.
2019.
Yeah, how are you feeling about it?
I don't know, I just didn't notice the difference, really. I think because New Year's Day is always so blur.
Oh, didn't we had a lovely New Year's Day?
No, but as in, like, it doesn't feel like New Year, New Year's Day.
It just feels
because
like
it's just a hangover.
Day. Yeah.
And a hangover on another day.
Yeah, and that's meant to be when you start your resolutions.
I know,
and you're
it's so
starting
stupid.
It off with a hangover and most likely eating your body weight in carbs.
Mm.
So, I mean, start as you mean to go on.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we're going to talk about that at all, but New Year's resolutions are kind of bull.
Yeah, don't do them.
So, what do you do? Intentions, don't you?
Yes, intentions.
I like that.
Yeah, you intend to do it. It doesn't mean you have to.
No, exactly. That's how I do my to-do list. I must have said that before. My to-do lists are like, you can do this if you want, but you don't feel like you have to. I'm not very productive.
Yeah, I was about to say, my to-do lists are a little bit more strict.
I do have some New Year's resolutions.
Okay.
Kind of.
Mm-hmm.
One is to read 5 books all year. For
That's
fun.
Good. For fun.
Yeah.
Because you do a lot of reading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, just because I want to, not because academia says I have to.
What they like. I just wrote a bunch of stuff down, and if it works, I'm not really keeping it in my mind.
I do like the idea of it being a time to take stock of things.
Mm-hmm.
It is a nice time to think, like, what am I doing right in my life? And what should I be changing? But not so much that you feel bad about it when you don't do it, because that's just stupid.
Mm-hmm. Very true. And how are we feeling about the world of feminism and human rights and equality?
I don't know, really. There's always... I feel like I'm being interviewed.
Oh, yeah, I've got an interview.
I know, you
haven't. I'm trying to deflect.
You're trying to deflect. Okay. I think, as ever, there's loads of positive things happening. At the same time, it's loads of shit things. So
same.
It's day
same
by
old,
day.
Same old.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. But we're going to hopefully bring
we'll
a little bit of light into this. Shall we kick off the first podcast of the year with a shot?
A shot. Oh, God.
I know. So we've got these little tiny cups. Did you swap them around?
No.
Because I swear yours was more full than mine.
They're the same.
Okay. So we've got these tiny chocolate cups with some slow gin in.
Oh, wait, went right. So the chocolate. When do I do the chocolate?
I think you shot it and then
I just want to put it all in. I'm just going to eat it.
All right, go on. I feel like the gin's going to explode out of your mouth.
No, it won't. I'll keep my mouth closed.
Okay.
And I'm going to do it away from the microphone. So, do you want to watch me first? Because I feel like you...
Yeah, okay. I'm waiting for this.
Okay, I'm ready.
That's not a good face.
No.
Is it not okay?
I'm sorry, really thank you for bringing them, but I feel sick.
No!
That was a bad idea, go on home.
I'm going to shot it and eat it.
Mm.
Yeah?
Mm.
Oh no, is it really bad? Oh no.
No, it's fine.
I'm going to cry. Okay, I'm going to get on with it.
Oh wow, I don't know if your way looks any better. Hannah's doing crying face now. I don't know if it's pain or pleasure. Okay, she looks quite happy.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend if you're going to do it, don't do it my method. That was fucking stupid.
Can I try to warn you a little bit?
I don't know. I just didn't want to do a shot, basically.
It is quite difficult to eat chocolate after doing a
shot. Yeah, and also I'm not convinced chocolate and gin go together.
Mm.
Maybe if it was a little...
Rum. Mm.
I didn't say rum. You just went, yeah, rum. I didn't
I read
say
your
anything.
Mind. That's what happened.
Yeah, maybe.
Mm.
Okay. Should we do the stuff we're good at, i.e. not shots?
Probably.
Might be wise.
We've wasted enough of these people's time.
These poor people.
Why do you keep
us.
Coming back? Seriously.
I know.
Question your life.
It's not as different.
No, I'm joking. Please come.
It's a different 16 people every time. I want to hear about the girl gang.
Yeah, so Thursday last week, I went to Girl Gang Manchester's event at the People's History Museum.
I love the People's History
Museum.
Yeah,
me too.
It's so nice.
Yeah. There was a woman from the museum who gave a little announcement and said, we're actually the National Museum for Democracy.
Whoa.
I didn't know that.
Didn't know there was one.
No, we that's have cool. one. It's right
we
there.
We have one and it's here.
Yeah. So that's cool. And there was a tour of the Represent exhibit. Been to it a few times, so it's got like the original suffragette banner.
I think I've seen it, yeah.
It's got lots of things from, you know, the suffragette movement up until modern day, and cool. It includes LGBTQ, it includes Black Asian ethnic minority, loads of stuff for young people. So it's very all-encompassing.
Stuff for young people?
Yeah, in terms of like giving young people a voice.
Oh, okay, I thought you meant stuff for young people as in for children.
No,
like,
no.
As in interactive like,
yeah,
features. And
young people and teenagers, oh, okay, kind okay, of. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. And it's on until February, so if you have not been yet and you live in Manchester or you're visiting, do you go.
That's cool.
Because it's actually really
February's going to come round quick, y'all.
Wow.
That's my input to that.
Yeah.
But yeah, what I'm trying to say is do it because you'll not get round to do it.
Mm-hmm. And then you'll be sad when you miss it.
I'm talking to myself mainly because I think I was thinking of a different exhibition when I said I'd been. I was lying.
Oh, well, you need to go.
Yeah, I'll go.
You need to go.
And I want to try speed mating that yes. Girl Gang do as well.
Yeah, so Girl Gang Manchester do this thing called speed mating. Everyone's welcome, but it's generally women that go. And
can men go?
Yeah, guys can go.
Can they?
Yeah. They like, say on their event pages it's open to everyone.
Oh.
So however you identify.
Oh.
It's just more about, I guess, more focused on women.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and you have 5-6 minutes to do like icebreakers with a complete stranger. You do them, you swap contacts, and you move on to the next person.
You swap contacts?
Yeah. Aww. I've got a little bit of paper that says new friends.
Oh.
And all them contacts
that's
on
so
there.
Nice.
And there were some really, really wonderful people.
I carry around a piece of paper that says new friends all the time. And I add people as I meet them.
Do you really?
No.
You should. I think we all should.
It might be so cute.
Yeah.
But imagine though, if you're just talking to someone, like, as an acquaintance, a passing conversation, then you get out your new friend's piece of paper and start writing their name down and they look at you like, what the fuck?
You could ask them, I suppose.
Would you like to be on my new friend list?
Oh, it's like being a kid. Would you like to be my friend?
No, simple, that was horrible when it was a kid, time. Though.
Why?
That was so, like, we can't get into it.
Okay. Let's move on. What's been going on with you?
I've been boring, because literally since Christmas got done, and New Year got done, and fun things got done, Nina got essay.
What's your essay about?
It's about this really, really, really brilliant book called The Swimming Pool Library by Alan Hollinghurst. He's won the Man Booker for a different book. It's set in the 1980s. It's about sort of the gay scene in London.
Oh, is it about like gay bathhouses?
Yeah. How do you know that?
I was listening to something about that.
What?
Kind of. So I was listening to an episode of This Podcast Will Kill You, and they were so they go through different diseases and viruses.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were going through HIV. So they were talking about basically the whole context around obviously the gay community in the 80s, and it was...
I'm interested as what they had to say about that.
Well, it was like they closed down bathhouses.
Okay, that they closed them down.
Yeah,
for no real reason.
The government is America under Reagan closed down gay bathhouses because they thought it was a breeding ground for HIV.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. Okay. Yeah. As long as we're saying that they thought it was and not that it was.
No. That's what, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. I've done a whole load of stuff about public sex and it never really being public, very rarely being public. The idea of public sex is a bit of a myth. All different gay spaces in London, like clubs, bathhouses, cinemas. It's brilliant. This book has so much to explore in it. So it makes for a hefty as fuck essay.
Yeah,
but it's good. I love it. Mm. You should read it.
Sounds good.
It's quite pornographic.
Well, that sounds fabulous.
Get to take that prude hat off, Hannah.
I don't have a prude hat on.
I'm only joking. You don't have a prude hat.
No, I don't. Oh, so another thing for me that happened recently, and is quite relevant, actually. I've been working on a song release for a Somali-Canadian artist called Amal.
Yeah.
And the song's called Not What I Thought. As well as being a musician, she's an activist, and she is the Goodwill Ambassador for Somali Women and Children, nice. And her Twitter is absolute fire. It's just so good.
Handle, please.
Amal Nook, so A M AALNUUX. And I actually have a really cool recent tweet from her that I want to read out.
Okay.
So she tweeted this on January 5th. Spent most of my adult womanhood deprogramming and going against a lot of things I was conditioned to believe were right. It's a long journey, but we really owe it to the future generations to do the work now and break these cycles of oppression.
True that.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, follow her for some sage advice.
Oh, I love people that bring that to Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Not just rubbish.
Oh, and I was going to say, we'll play the song at the end of this episode.
Oh, yeah.
So do stick around for that, because it's wonderful.
Oh, no, I'm glad we're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I approve.
Good, I'm glad you have your approval.
We don't talk about what we're going to do. So it's like, I'm going to play a whole album this episode. No, Nina, you're not.
We'll just push it as far as we can go.
Today we're going to watch a whole film.
And we're going to describe it to you.
Oh, no. That is a thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a thing. Yeah.
Like, I don't think we're the people to do it.
No, we're not. I use it for, like, to cope with insomnia.
Okay.
What do you think I was going to say? Your eyes went all wide and scared.
I don't know what I thought was going to happen.
I don't know either.
It's fine. Should we do some of the news stuff?
Current news, yeah.
Current news?
Mm-hmm.
Who go first?
You go first.
Me go first. Okay, so I've got an article for you by Snita Poonam on The Guardian. So basically, I've been seeing a lot in the news about a certain wall. This is kind of a nicer wall that I don't know if you'll have heard anything about.
I'm so glad that we're not talking about the orange man.
No, we're talking about some Indian women doing an amazing form of protest.
Okay.
So, I'll do the backstory and the why and the whole thing. I'll tell you the story.
I'm really nervous because I have a story.
Oh no.
About Indian women and protesting. Carry on.
It must be there.
No, carry on.
Okay. So, on the 1st of January, over 5 million women lined up across the length of the southern state of Kerala in a protest asserting their right to enter the Sabarimala temple in Kerala.
Yep.
Oh, Hannah!
But I think I might have a different spin on it, so okay. you go on.
Okay. Okay, so this, yeah, so it was about them having the right to enter this Sabarimala temple, which exclusively has only been for men and older women to preserve the mythological celibacy of the ruling deity within the temple.
Yeah.
Ayyappa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's basically, if you are of menstruating age, it's typically women and girls aged 10 to 50 are not allowed in this temple. And it's like, sorry, but what?
I know.
Like,
Sorry,
just because, like, someone's over 50, all of a sudden they're no longer on the god's radar. But... And also, he needs to have some self-control.
I know. If your deity is going
to... If he's meant to be celibate.
Uncelibated just at the sight of a menstruating woman, I think he's not so much of a god, is he?
Nope.
Right. What side have you taken on it? Because I can adjust.
Just carry on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, basically, in September, there was a ruling by the High Court which forced the temple to open its doors to women of all ages, which was a big old shake-up of religious tradition for this temple. This clearly was supposed to be a positive step, but it just resulted in complete mayhem. Between the 17th of November and the 24th of December, more than a dozen women of menstrual age, including reporters, tried to enter the temple but were stopped, shoved, stoned by mobs, just prevented from entering the temple in a violent and pretty horrible way by male devotees, hoping to preserve the celibacy, I guess, of this deity. None of the women that tried could make it in, even though the police were on their sides, like, protecting them.
Yep.
Men were just not giving in.
So yeah, there was, like, devotees throwing stones at the police and stopping traffic, just making as much of a nuisance as possible.
It sounds pretty crazy and stupid.
And immature.
On the 22nd of January, the court is going to hear a handful of petitions that are asking to cancel the earlier ruling of letting women of menstruating age into the temple. So they're going to hear out the people preventing these women getting in. And it's also since been revealed that a survey showed 75% of people in Kerala actually disagreed with the decision to let women in.
Yeah.
That's men and women surveyed, allegedly. Claims have also been made that it was only in the interests of a handful of leftist activists trying to enter the temple, and the majority of Kerala's ordinary women preferred the status quo.
Yeah, and this is sadly true, and there's even been a campaign started by women, and they've called it hashtag ready to wait.
Wait for what?
For the menopause. So that's when they can go in the temple.
Oh.
Yeah, so they wrote because they agree with the ban, and they... It stems from a respect for religious tradition. However, they've got the flip side of it where the government have found that it was actually unconstitutional, that it prevented women's rights to religious freedom.
It was only upholding already existing laws, wasn't it? It was only bringing it into line with constitutional freedom of women to be able to go to the same places as men. Like the bench said when they were letting women in, changing this law, they said where a man can enter, a woman can also go. What applies to a man applies to a woman. So in theory, this obviously should have been positive, but it caused such backlash. But on the plus side, this protest was phenomenal. I have never seen anything like it. Have you seen the videos and stuff?
I haven't, actually.
It's truly amazing. That kind of organisation, they're all just stood there, shoulder to shoulder, hand in hand. It's just the best image of protest you could put. It's peaceful, they're just stood there. It's amazing.
And compare that to the devotees or the people who support the ban and their behaviour.
They're throwing stones. It was over 385 miles, one of the largest ever congregations of women in the world. And this has rekindled hopes for a genuine movement bringing about social and religious reform from the bottom up. It was a range of women taking part, young and old, rural and urban, farmers and doctors, activists and actors, taking the pledge to fight for gender equality. Early the next morning, so that was the 1st of January, so early on the 2nd of January, two women, Bindu Hariharan or Amini, I saw two different sources for her surname, I'm not sure which, and Kanaka Durga, went into Sarabarimala. They'd already tried on the 24th of December, but couldn't get in. And on the morning of the 2nd, they did. I read that in an article that was written on the 3rd of January. But I checked to see if any updates had happened. And there was one today or yesterday. And it turns out that these women since have been unable to return home because they're receiving threats from hardline Hindu groups.
Absolutely insane. I obviously found the same article, and I got it on a website called Bust, and they went at 3:45 a.m. To the temple with police escorts to protect them, and rather than being allowed in the sacred entrance, they had to go through a back entrance. They were dressed entirely in black, covered head to toe, and there were still people protesting against them entering. It's like they literally bent over backwards to meet you halfway.
It's the most amenable way they could possibly have gone about it.
What I think one thing that really shocked me actually was after they left the temple, priests immediately closed it for purification rituals, which usually occur after blood is spilled or a child urinates accidentally. So that's the level they're putting women.
That is insanity.
Women who have not yet hit menopause entering the temple.
That is literally
it's so disrespectful.
I'll never understand the mindset of the women, the hashtag ready to wait. Obviously, you can't speak for other people, and what you find disrespectful doesn't necessarily mean that they find it disrespectful, and it clearly doesn't. But the idea of being just unable to go somewhere and then having to go to that much length just because you've stepped foot in a place, they feel like they have to clean it. Just on a base level, that's insulting.
I think, obviously, for both the priests and the devotees and the women who support the ban, it's all about respecting religious tradition. I do understand that. Obviously, you want to have respect for traditions, but at what cost? At the cost of human rights. I don't think that is a tradition anyone should uphold.
I don't think it's a tradition any religion actually proposes. That's not really the point.
Well, that's apparently as well the this particular sect of Hinduism are supposedly very progressive, very peaceful.
It's so hard to reconcile the peace and the joy and the good things that religion can put forward with how it can be interpreted sometimes. It just blows my mind.
And it gets, as has always been throughout entire history, wrapped up in politics.
Of course, everything is. Mm-hmm.
So the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, which is the political party of India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, believes women visiting the temple to be a, and I quote, conspiracy by the atheist rulers to destroy the Hindu temples.
Conspiracy. Do we know the meaning of the word conspiracy? Mm-hmm. I don't think it can be a conspiracy if it's over what's like, that's just ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. It's like, atheism is not a part of it. It's completely the opposite. These are women that want to show their...
Exactly. Why would they want to be in the temple if they were atheists? No one's going to just go for... Well, people do just go for the crack, don't they? But, like, this is not one of them.
Yeah, it's very, very paranoid. Obviously, India's massive. So every area is different. You say it's... Kerala has a communist government in the local area. And they found that it's a violation of women's rights. So you also already have these two political forces at loggerheads.
Mm.
And they just, it's just religion is getting blurred into it. When did you say they're going to have the...
22nd of January?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot could happen between now and then. I mean, it's already... That process was so massive. How can that go unnoticed? I mean...
I know. At the same time, there's been multiple protests and petitions from people who support the ban.
Yeah.
So I guess the Supreme Court is reconsidering for that reason, because it is a democratic country.
I would be interested to see what they
decide. Yeah.
It'd be kind of bonkers if they revoke it now.
It would be, yeah, it would be.
I don't know, it remains to be seen. We'll keep an eye on it.
I'm also going to give a shout out to BuzzFeed. First time I've gone on the website.
Yeah, I've
it was a really good article.
Yeah.
They cited all their sources, which I always like. You can go for a little explore. When I scroll down to the bottom of the article, they have a free download of A Feminist Guide to Resistance.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah.
I love one of them. We downloaded.
I haven't read it yet.
I'm going to print it out.
Oh, yeah. So that's our homework, I think.
I like that.
Feminist Guide to Resistance, and then we'll be back. You know.
I don't have enough feminist literature to be...
Oh, I know.
...to be cracking on with.
I don't think... I have a lot of feminist theory.
Mm.
Not so much... feminist practicality stuff.
You've got books.
I have books.
You want bare books?
Yeah, I know, but it's like a lot of it's theory and opinion. Yeah. It's not like stuff I can actually use.
Well,
I don't know.
Line is fine between...
The
line is fine between education and activism. Mm-hmm.
So who on earth goes next? Because...
I don't know, because we just trod all over each other's toes.
We did.
Our feet are just everywhere. I can go again.
Go on. Don't be stealing another one.
I don't know. I'm a bit scared now. At the start of that one, I was just looking at you with every sentence like, is it this? Is it this?
Yeah.
Okay, so I've got another story for you that has a bit of a misleadingly positive headline.
Okay.
It's a Vice story.
Mm-hmm.
It's from Vice France, and I read the English translation because I'm lazy.
You can read the French one.
I know. It was written by Manon Welkin, oh my gosh, and Edouard Richard. I think he just did the photography, to be honest, I'm not going to lie.
Well, that's fine.
But he's on the, what do we call it, the sub bit underneath the heading, the headline.
The byline?
The byline, yeah.
Oh.
He's on the byline, so we'll say him. Okay, so... a recent law change has led to a rise in the number of violent attacks on sex workers in France.
Wait, a law change has led to the rise?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I will go into detail. This story is it's set in Paris, and it's sort of centred around this woman called Samantha, who is a sex worker and employee of Bus des Femmes, as in, like, women's bus.
Okay.
Which is an organisation providing a range of welfare services to sex workers in the area surrounding the Bois de Boulogne. That degree's useful. Which is a public park in Western Paris. So, contextually for this, back in April 2018, trans sex worker Vanessa Campos was killed age just 26, while trying to protect her colleague from being robbed.
That's so upsetting.
Since then, there's just been an enormous number of violent attacks on sex workers in the area, and the government has been doing, and the local
authorities,
I suppose is the word, have been doing nothing to help and kind of a lot to hinder. It would be pretty easy to argue. So Samantha, this woman that works for Boost des Femmes, runs weekly rounds to check in on the area's sex worker community. So the law change I was talking about before was the French government introducing a €1,500 fine for anyone caught paying for sex. That's about £1,350.
Okay.
That's made customers a lot more wary, and it's put off a lot of the, in inverted commas, good customers. That's how they describe them. And made the whole working environment for them a lot more dangerous. So prostitution is legal in France, but the introduction of this fine is thought to have been partly intended as a deterrent. But instead of working as planned, it's the sex workers who have suffered, with clients now regularly asking women for sex in secluded areas to avoid the police. Oh. Which, obviously, ding ding ding, big alarm bells.
This is such a random connection, okay. But they did the fucking same thing when Jack the Ripper was around.
I read a book about it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, sorry.
I didn't read a book. I probably watched it on telly, to be honest. But yeah, the police were like turfing women and sex workers out of brothels where, you know,
they forced them onto the streets so they could lure out Jack the Ripper.
Yeah. No, well, I didn't.
No, that's...
To lure out Jack the Ripper. Yeah. I thought the reason that Jack the Ripper was able to find these women was because they had been turfed out of brothels. So the first woman was killed because there were so many prostitutes on the streets, not because they
That is how it started. And then, obviously, with the police not caring, they did nothing to protect the sex workers on the streets and just allowed it to go on. And it wasn't until, a mother that wasn't a sex worker was killed that they actually started taking it seriously.
Surprise, surprise.
I know. But,
yeah. So, yeah, so don't learn anything.
It's an age-old story, basically, this one. A survey conducted by Médecins du Monde of nearly 600 sex workers in France, 63 of them said they'd seen their working conditions deteriorate since the law change, while 42% said that they've experienced more violence since the law change. Samantha, the woman that we were talking about before, estimates that every 3 days a girl is attacked, which is pretty horrible.
Is it just... So she's just looking at women, not sex workers who are other genders?
Trans women and women.
Okay.
Sex workers. Okay. I believe she's a trans woman. There's an also interesting side story about sex workers and vans in Paris. A lot of them have kind of cool, jazzed up vans that they work in, but it's like a whole culture of these jazzy vans all over parks, and they're actually kind of pretty and cool.
Well, I think this might be the same loophole that we have in the UK law.
Yeah.
Where if it's a mobile home or mobile vehicle, that it doesn't act, there is no like law that says you can't use that as a brothel and sell sex out of them. And it was actually I heard about that in a documentary by the WI.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so they investigated basically standards for sex workers in the UK. They went to different countries to look at how places like, for example, Amsterdam have their sex industry set up.
Okay.
And then they went to the government and handed in their findings and were like, here you go, this is how to make it better.
Oh.
Mm. To, like, older women as well, in like over 60.
That's really cool.
It was so good.
I love that.
It's one of my favourite documentaries.
I need to watch that. Link me.
Yes, we should share it as well.
That's a good idea. So this organisation, Boost des Femmes, does rounds, like I said before. On the rounds, they ask women for names, nationalities, to document the information about them on a route map so they know where all the sex workers are working, they know who they are, they know who's going to be missing if anyone is missing. Mm. They invite people in to this van for like snacks and drinks, whatever, but they have like condoms, whatever these women might need. but unfortunately few actually use the service fully because they're worried spending time away from being in public view and being hidden by the van or in the van, they're missing out on clients.
Right.
It's a big old shame. They interview a few of the sex workers on the rounds. There's an Ecuadorian woman called Marie, who has been working in and around this park for 19 years. In that time, she says it's been harder and harder to make money. She says more and more the clients try to negotiate with you. I have 20-year-olds who come and ask me for, in inverted commas, a little fellatio for just 20 euros. When I was talking before about the local authorities really hindering rather than helping, and another example of that is that they have gone and shut off many of the lights in the park in the evenings.
Oh my god!
To discourage people from soliciting.
What the actual...
I know. I just couldn't believe that.
That is absurd!
I know.
Not only does it endanger the lives of the sex workers who are still going to go there because they still, like, they have a spot, they've probably, like, that woman, she's probably been in the same spot for years. People know that she's there.
Mm.
But it's also going to increase so many other kinds of crime.
Yeah, exactly. It's ridiculous. I don't understand how that would ever be a solution to everything.
Oh, my blood is boiling.
I know. I couldn't believe that. It's fucking 21st century. That's ridiculous. So for this reason, again, the good clients, like I said before, have fled because they're worried about getting this fine. There was also a big section in the article about these women now, unsurprisingly at all, are now carrying weapons a lot, but that has meant that a few women have been prosecuted for self-defence. Someone was put in prison, I believe, for like 3 years for tear gassing a client that attacked her.
What's the alternative?
Yeah, like, sorry, I should have let myself be attacked. There's a new self-defence workshop that's been set up for and by sex workers. Not new, it was created in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Before the law came into effect, it's an inter-associative project called SWAG.
Nice.
Headed by Médecins du Monde. In collaboration.
is French for collaboration? Collaboration?
Oh, I don't know.
Very convincing.
Collaboration.
Collaboration. No, what did I go? What was my accent?
I don't know. It wasn't one I've heard of on this planet.
special blend.
In collaboration with Acceptus T. And the sex workers union, STRAS. They've got some good names, these things, haven't they? Pesha, who is a sex worker and course leader for SWAG, says it's a workshop where you learn to defend yourself both verbally and physically. The idea is to have trainers in every community, and currently there are about a dozen of us. In spite of the death of Vanessa Campos back in 2018, and the media's focus on several similar attacks since, the authorities are still not taking the problem seriously. The measures the women have set up to help each other, welfare associations, self-defence classes, they're not enough in the face of a deeply flawed law. The women can't even work together, again, just all the ways to make the situation more dangerous. They can be arrested for sharing a truck. Because that constitutes a brothel,
wow.
I believe, yeah. On a positive side, Médecins du Monde is currently developing an app designed to protect sex workers, which should go live in June 2019. Accessible in 7 languages, it will allow women to send alerts to each other, and in the event of a problem, share their location. I was trying to find some more info on this, because it sounds really cool, but it's literally only in this article, as far as I can see.
It's a great way to go around these ridiculous laws.
Yeah, exactly.
And somehow unify sex workers who are on the streets. It's also really upsetting that
it's needed.
It's that's the most they can do.
Yeah, exactly.
And that shouldn't be like that.
No, it's insanity.
Hmm.
It's just like a whole list of ways to deal with the situation badly.
Yeah,
it is quite reminiscent of the Jack the Ripper stuff, to be honest.
Hmm.
Which is didn't end well. So
no, I don't believe it did.
No.
And what is it going to? Is it going to take something like that?
Well, it's already happened.
To wake up. Well, that's true.
So
that is true.
Yeah,
it's good to bring that to everyone's attention.
Yeah, I thought we'd do a little global hop tonight.
Global hops. Yeah.
Yeah. Done a bit of India. Done a bit of France.
Well, let's go to I think America.
You think?
I think.
Okay, we'll try
that's
that.
Where the Golden Globes are, right? Completely different.
Yes.
Yes. Like Hollywood.
Sure. Hollywood. I've heard of that.
completely different to what you have done. You've done a very serious thing. I'm about to get less so.
That's all right, I could have that.
Yeah. It's been a year since Time's Up was a real presence at the last Golden Globes.
Okay, yeah.
So it's again thinking back to that time and whether it's still having a lasting impact year on. And again, the Golden Globes have been a very feminist platform.
Nice.
Yeah, so, you know, these are bigger names and they are using their voice to hopefully inspire other women. And I picked out a few notable moments from the Golden Globes.
That's good, because I didn't read anything about it, so you can keep me young.
I don't know, is it a young person thing?
I don't know, it's kind of like a cool person thing, isn't it?
Is it?
I don't know, I feel like it's a thing people know that
happens.
The occasional once a year. Tweet about.
Yeah, indeed. So, let's kick off with Regina King, who is a director, producer and actress.
Mm-hmm.
A Cinderella Story, she was in that. Did you ever watch that with Hilary Duff?
Yeah, the one with Chad Michael Murray.
Yeah.
I like that. Wait, what, she was in that?
Yeah, she was the... she worked in the diner.
Yeah.
And then Legally Blonde 2.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of, like, movies we've probably watched. Because there was many others. She's been in tons.
Yeah, I recognise her from... She's in loads of stuff.
Yeah. Anyway, Regina King. So she's pledged that everything she produces in the next 2 years will have a cast and crew made up of 50% women. She's great. Good pledge.
Yeah.
I really loved this statement from her. I challenge anyone out there in a position of power, not in just your industry, in all industries. I challenge you to challenge yourself and to stand with us in solidarity and do the same.
A lot of challenging. She likes a challenge.
Yeah. That's what we need. And another person that I think had a notable moment was Glenn Close, who won the Golden Globe for Best Actress in a Drama Motion Picture, which was in The Wife, which I have not seen.
Or heard of.
No, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Glenn. She's catching up with, that's what she said. She's going to be so disappointed we don't know anything about her.
I think, like, if she's going to listen to us, we should probably watch her film.
I mean, we know who's bigger out of the two of us, but it does seem fair to
Golden
give
Globe,
her a watch.
Shmogan Globe.
Yes, yeah, that. Golden Globe, Shmogan Globe. Oh my god, these sausage.
Back to Glenn Close, who can actually talk.
I hope so. I hope she did her speech a bit better.
that was notable.
Okay.
Right. So, yeah, she won an award for her performance in The Wife. Do you have a little summary here for us uneducated lot?
Yeah, that's awesome.
She plays the unfulfilled spouse of a narcissistic...
Is there any other kind of spouse? I'm joking.
Of a narcissistic Nobel Prize winning husband. And she said the role taught her that women need to follow our dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Because women are often expected to be nurturers. So whether that be for children, for family members, for spouses.
Yeah.
And here's her quote from her. We have our children. We have our husband, if we're lucky enough. And our partners, whoever. But we have to find personal fulfillment.
Yes.
And I think maybe for me and you, it's not like something we can totally relate to because we're kind of just like floating around on our own in this world. But I think there are going to be women out there who have fell into a trap of unfulfillment.
Yeah, definitely.
And hopefully for them, seeing films like that and actresses like Glenn Close, they'll be inspired to take a bit of life for themselves.
I do think a lot of women, I mean, if I think of like my grandma's generation, especially, probably my mum's generation to an extent, women do just forget to follow their own dreams, I think.
Yeah.
Even less than that, just find things that are for them. I think it's so important, like that was saying, it's so important to do things that are just for you.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely. I think it's much easier as a woman to feel like that's not something you're allowed.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of guilt.
Else, yeah, everything guilt. Else must come before that. But obviously doing things that are just for you are so fucking important.
I think our generation have been kind of, like, brought up with this idea.
Mm.
And older generations perhaps haven't. Yeah.
I think, I don't know, I always feel like I got conflicting
messages
about that.
Yeah.
Because, like, definitely in my family home, it was like, no, you have to do things that are good for you. And yet somehow it still seeped into me somewhere. Because I definitely, like, I don't know, you do still kind of believe.
I think I had the opposite.
Yeah.
Completely. Like, the upbringing was like, you do things that, like, you put yourself last.
Yeah.
Very, like, kind of self-sacrificing. Mm. But it was from the stance of being selfless.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is conflicting because both things have merit.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a much bigger question. We need, like, a philosopher in here or something.
Yeah. I know a person that does a philosophy podcast.
Oh.
Maybe we should get her on.
Should give him a shout-out.
Yeah, we should actually. It's been overdue. Two philosophers, one podcast, no problems?
Two philosophers, one podcast, no problems.
It's my friend Liv and her friend Shidi is doing a philosophy PhD.
Wow.
At Edinburgh Uni.
Oh, fancy.
And the podcast, I believe, is funded by Edinburgh Uni Philosophy Department. I know.
The dream!
I know, I'm just like trying not to be
selfish. Can we get in touch with Manchester Uni?
I don't know what. I suppose literally my course would be the ones to sponsor us.
Yes, they should. I don't know if they'll sponsor me.
I don't think we have any money.
Sorry, but how does the philosophy department have any money?
I don't know, they don't need to spend any money on equipment because the equipment is the brain.
Oh.
Two philosophers. Yeah, I was right. I shouldn't have doubted myself.
Ooh.
Two philosophers, one podcast, no problems.
Yeah.
Liv and Elliot. Listen to that.
Shouts.
Shouts? Is that how we do shout outs now?
Shouts!
I'm just shouts out. That was a big old floppy tangent, wasn't it?
Oh no, big old floppy tangent. Oh, title contender.
Oh no.
Big old floppy tangent.
Oh, this citrus tea's put me right up. Okay, I'm going to do a positive story because I feel like I just need positivity right now. Given we've done India, we've done France. I'm going to take you to Leeds.
Oh, nice. Exotic.
Have you heard of Are We Nearly Bare Yet?
No.
Oh my god. I'm so excited about this. It's closer to home, which makes it more exciting somehow, because that's how life works. So it's based on an Instagram account, but the bulk of this is from an interview with the creator of Are We Nearly Bare Yet, Louisa Foley, written by Jennifer Lee O'Brien for The City Talking, which is a Leeds-based film studio, magazine and creative agency.
Mm.
So it's an old interview, but the Instagram account it's talking about has just, like, taken off in the past few months.
Okay.
And this is kind of the only coverage of it in the news, which is a bit bonkers. So I guess that's what we're doing. So, Louisa Foley transforms nude portraits into graphic pictures using kaleidoscopic colours. Now, if you follow her Instagram account, it's not the personal one, but the Are You Nearly Bare Yet account. It's a project that she started for people to send in their nudes, and she makes them into graphic art with bright colours.
What?
I'll have to show you. But, like,
you will have to show me.
We'll put them on the socials as well, because yes, they're so gorgeous. But my friend Leonie had one done.
Really?
For herself. She won't mind me saying. Like, she bought, like, got one commissioned for herself for a, like, a little self-love Christmas present.
Aww.
And she showed it to me, and it's so beautiful.
Like, that's awesome.
They're so good. So Louisa Foley started doing this with drawings of her friends from Leeds, where she studied at Leeds Art University, and from Eastbourne, where she grew up. But the bulk of the drawings are complete strangers that have submitted their pictures to her Instagram account, where they've seen her drawings online and want to be drawn too. She isn't even, like, she's not, her specialism was never drawing. Her qualification is printed textiles, because a tutor told her drawings weren't strong enough.
Ugh.
but it was a man. So she graduated 3 years ago and now works at a bar restaurant in Leeds, which I'm the same town before. I'm going to try and go to.
Yeah, you should.
I want to meet her.
I think you should just like go in and go right up to her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think I know what she looks like, but I'll find out. I'll figure it out.
You ask whoever's working there. Is Louisa working here today?
Yeah. I wonder if she's got fans. I will be that person. Mm-hmm. Blah, blah, blah. So where she's been working, the owners have let her, I mean, obviously it's an honour to them, but she's been displaying her work and selling her work from there as well.
Oh, that's cool.
Not the nudes, though.
Okay.
Like her other graphic stuff. She says in this interview that people have sent her messages saying how liberating it is and that she gets a real buzz from that. Growing up, there was always so much competition with other girls, and now that I'm an adult, I feel like women are really supportive of each other, especially in the area I've chosen to work in. She says Leeds is a great city for new artists, and she thinks there's a real big crossover between the service industry and art in Leeds, which I think is quite interesting.
I think that can be said for a lot of cities.
Yeah, it's like the flexibility of working in like hospitality with being creative, I guess. She said loads of people are asking her about like a deadline for this, when she's going to stop, but she just wants to keep on going. I guess I'll stop when I run out of people that want to be drawn, but aww, I can't see that happening. And this was back in April last year that this interview was taking place, and it's taken off so much since then that I don't think she's ever going to be able to stop if she sticks to that deadline. So on her Instagram, in like the highlights bit, she did like frequently asked questions and stuff, but they were quite nice. So I'm going to read what she put in there. She says, "Are We Nearly Bare Yet? Is for women of all walks of life, trans women, cis women, disabled women, old women, young women, women of colour, women of all shapes and sizes, and every woman in between," in capitals. "I've always strived to make this a fully inclusive project for all women, creating a safe space to express and liberate themselves through nudity and art. No woman shall ever be turned away or excluded."
That's amazing.
She added afterwards on a separate, like, highlight thing, which I have to feel is a response to someone annoying, "This isn't a project created to exclude men. This is a project that's been created to celebrate women."
Yes.
So at the time of the interview, she wasn't charging for the pictures. Thankfully, she has realised her own worth and has since monetized the project.
Cool.
You can buy her prints, the not custom nudes, on her website from £8. And the custom nudes start at £40, which is not really that bad.
Nope.
That's such a nice idea.
And people should pay for that art.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we need to support artists.
Exactly. I'm more than happy to. So her website is arewenearlybareyet.com, and basically you submit your nude, and she says it's best if you like submit a few so she can get an idea of your vibe, and then she like chooses your colours for you, and it's just a really nice positive thing.
Very cool.
I really hope my friend Leonie's goes on the Instagram. I don't know, because like not all of them do.
Yeah,
like, you have to get permission.
Yeah.
But I hope she did, because I want to see hers. It was so good. And it was really cute, because when she showed it me, she was saying that like she's got massive, fiery red hair. It's absolutely gorgeous.
It's amazing.
And she always wears green, because it looks so good with her hair, and it looks so good on her. And she was like, "I didn't specify any colours, or like any colours I wanted excluded. I just kind of hoped, like, deep down a little bit, that it would be green." And it was.
Aww.
So I was like, oh.
Yeah.
This is so nice.
Awesome. So that's Are We Nearly Bare Yet? Cool. Oh, we'll check
bear
them
as
out.
In naked, bear as in not grizzly. Just in case. It was just someone was picturing something
bear
else.
Bear nudes.
Yeah. bear nudes.
Bear nudes. All right. So on our global hop-in tour.
Ooh, we're doing that today, aren't we?
We're going back to Saudi Arabia because it's got a lot going on.
Yep.
And the Saudi Crown Prince has implemented a new law to end secret divorces.
Interesting.
I found this piece on a website called Mamma Mia. Yep.
Here you go again, Hannah.
Are you proud of yourself?
I didn't want to do it, but I just had to. That, like, she didn't even warrant me, like, I didn't even get an eye roll.
You got a sigh.
Just a... Okay. Let's pretend that didn't happen.
We can't. It's staying
just
in.
Just move on.
No, it's staying... Right.
Okay.
So the law means that women in Saudi Arabia will now be notified by text message if they have been divorced.
What?
Under the new law, which is designed to protect them from having their marriage ended without their knowledge.
Didn't know that was a thing?
Yes.
Okay.
So before this, a man could divorce his wife, never tell her, never notify her. She would just carry on. So they'd be separated, obviously, but she would just carry on assuming she was married, therefore unable to marry anyone else. There's probably other implications.
Yeah.
So while that law hasn't been ended, they at least now get notification that they are divorced.
A literal notification.
That's
crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that as a text. Fucking hell, I thought I'd received some bad text in my life.
Don't know, it might be a bit of a relief.
Yeah.
So the Saudi Ministry of Justice put out a statement saying that Saudi courts have started to send such divorce notifications, a step aimed at protecting the rights of female clients. So a representative for the global rights group Equality Now, Suad Abu Daye, said, at least women will know now whether they are divorced or not.
Seems like a pretty fundamental... Fundamental. That's the word.
Yeah. She goes on to say, it's a tiny step, but it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I am a big fan of this Crown Prince.
Mm. He's been doing some, like, forward shit, really. Yeah.
So he gave women the right to drive.
Yep.
He said you don't need to wear the abaya.
Mm-hmm.
And now he is at least allowing women to be notified that they're divorced.
What a luxury. Okay. Yeah.
And but considering it's been such an extremist country in the past, very conservative, still is in a lot of ways. These are huge strides.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're happening really fast.
I know, it's a lot. Yeah. There's been like 3 in a year or something.
Yeah, in the space of a year, pretty much. Big up.
Oh, you're using my line now. Me?
Mm-hmm.
You? Okay. This was an interesting one because I was going to do it as a little palate cleanser at the end. And then when I did literally one Google search of it, I stupidly got out like... realised that the world is bigger than my little nice white bubble.
Okay.
And realised it's not all as positive as I thought.
All right, I'm interested.
So I'm referring to the January movement. Have you seen that?
No.
It's kind of like November, but for women and body hair.
Okay.
So I was Googling it because I was just going to basically talk about the movement, which wouldn't have been a great story because it's pretty self-explanatory. You just grow out your body hair for January.
Yeah, when you said January, I was like, I've never heard of it before, but just from that name, I can guess what it is.
Yeah, it didn't really warrant a whole discussion. But from the research I did, why am I saying research? From the Google search I did, I found an article on Jezebel by Prashi Gupta, basically just, I don't need to say basically because I'm going to tell you about it.
Cool.
Okay, so it's questioning whether or not we should really be excited about any concept of a January. It's not a big deal, and basically we shouldn't be excited about it. I'll read what she has to say about it. Gupta says, we live in a stupid world where a bunch of men decided that women are more fuckable when their bodies more closely resemble naked mole rats. So yes, choosing not to participate in that and learning to love your bod is a wonderful, good, important thing. Yes. Mm-hmm. Agree. She goes on to say that she supports the intentions if it's encouraging more women to embrace their bodies, but let's keep this in perspective. A white woman discovering and promoting the wonders of not shaving her pits in the dead cold of winter, when we shave the least anyway, is not a particularly brave stance. Pretty white women are often celebrated for their bushy eyebrows or for their courageousness in growing long silky strands in their armpits, but it's black and brown women and trans people we should be honouring and highlighting. They are routinely mocked, harassed and threatened for refusing to conform to Eurocentric Western standards of beauty. It goes on to discuss how white women growing out their hair tends to be, like, especially blonde white women, like fairer complexions, finer hair. It's not as much of a visual statement, whereas... and I quote, brown people who have darker and oftentimes coarser, thicker hair and in more places are contending with colonialist expectations of what their bodies and hair are supposed to look like.
The stereotype you brought up there, so white, blonde, white, fair woman, she's going to skip shaving once a week.
Yeah.
It's not like a brown or black person who is told you need to be hairless to be attractive.
Exactly.
Who go through...
hours
like
a day.
Waxes. Shaving every day. Laser treatment. Like, so expensive. Also, and unnecessary.
It does, when you think about it for more than a minute, which obviously I hadn't done until I started thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So she talks about Fahira Roysan, a queer Muslim writer, who told ID, "White women not removing body hair is quite laughable to me. White women don't have the history or the baggage of growing up with visible body hair, so their announcement of it or political positionality of it seems insincere. Many brown folks, including me, were bullied growing up for being too hairy. When there's no history of subjugation or even cultural abuse, it seems premature to align yourself with something that essentially has no consequence for you, irrespective of how vocal you are with it. I'd say I'm ashamed that I hadn't thought about it, but it's just kind of a product of my own existence. But I'm so glad that I found this and have thought bigger for once, because this, it's just so obvious and it's just so, I don't shave anyway, really, because I can't be bothered and I've got really fair hair and it doesn't show. But, like, even my friends that I have with dark hair, I know that that's, more of a consideration for them. Having to go through it just to be acceptable. Like, when I don't shave, no one can tell. That's why I don't shave. If you could tell, I would.
Yeah, I also think there is a lot of pressure as a feminist to not shave.
Exactly.
And that is completely unfeminist.
Mm.
Everyone should be allowed to do whatever the hell they want. If you want to shave, shave. If you want to not shave, if you want to do it sometimes and not do it other times.
Such a white woman's stance. It's such a white feminist stance, traditionally and historically.
Oh, you have to grow out your hair to be a proper feminist.
Yeah. Mm. Because growing out your hair isn't a big deal. It's got no weight. It's got no bearing on your existence.
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to abuse you verbally or otherwise for it, really.
I find the topic of body hair very fascinating.
It is. It's so divided.
It's like nothingness.
Mm.
And it sparks such debate.
I know.
Did I tell you about the time I went to Manchester Art Gallery for a Women's Institute tour?
No, you might have done, but I don't remember.
So, yeah, they were doing a tour of the gallery and looking at pieces relating to women in art, which was really cool. So we're going around and being educated by this wonderful tour guide. And at one time she just stopped us and she said, "Look around at all the women in the room." And not the real women, the painted women.
Yeah.
"What do you not see?" And one person almost immediately said, "Body hair."
Yeah.
In art,
there's
no body hair.
That's crazy.
And I think, you know, in some, yes, and probably more modern stuff, yes, but traditionally, women in art have no body hair.
I wonder how old that dates, because when did people start?
Well,
okay.
There's a suggestion that when we uncovered all the ancient Greek statues, such as the very famous Venus de Milo, which is the woman without her arms, because they were broken off. When it was noticed that none of the statues had body hair, men and women alike.
Yeah. And it's pretty hard to sculpt it.
That's a suggestion, is it? It's either A, too hard to sculpt, skip it. Or B, the ancient Greek culture suggested that you need to shave, such as the ancient Egyptian culture had the same thing.
Yeah, it's like wrestling. Well, ancient Greece, the nude wrestling and stuff, I feel like.
Oh, maybe.
I don't know, that might be a bit of a jump.
I hadn't gone that far, no. And there is a belief that because in the Western world we celebrate ancient Greek and Latin art forms so much, that just became the norm.
That's the image.
Then we all saw that in art, and then we replicate that in ourselves.
So we're all real high culture, if you think about it.
Or just very suggestible.
Yeah. Probably the latter.
So yeah, next time you're in an art gallery, look out for some pubes. Tell me if you
can find any.
Probably not.
You're going to get some horrible DMs on Twitter now. "How do I find a pube?"
"Went to the loo, found a pube."
"That's not what I meant."
Oh, God.
That's funny.
Mm-hmm. What are we up to?
I'll just wrap that up with how she wrapped it up, because I liked her final sentence. She just said, "With that I say, it's January. It's cold. Grow your hair out or don't. I honestly don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Just remember that feminism isn't a white woman's cute 1 month hashtag exploration on Instagram."
Yes. Nice. Big Nicely up. Put.
I'm going to follow this woman now because I like the way she writes.
This is no way related, but none of our things are. So,
they never are.
Where the hell was that story from?
I've just closed the email. to myself.
Like geography wise?
Oh, UK.
Oh. Well, staying in the UK.
Oh, that was geography wise, UK.
We're going to...
Internet wise, Jezebel.
Oh, cool, cool. We're going to Scotland.
I nearly went to Scotland.
In your...
For the podcast.
In your news, yeah. Okay. Fave, Nicola Sturgeon, has issued an apology following Alex Salmond's win of a legal case over a sexual harassment inquiry.
Okay.
So, I felt like probably... It just hasn't that been that much in the main news.
No, I've not.
Especially if you're not in the UK.
Yeah.
Perhaps if you're in Scotland, you'll know more about it. So I hopped over onto the BBC because they do some pretty good timelines. So it's the BBC timeline that just takes you through the entire process.
Oh, I love it when they do that.
Very helpful. Yep. So this all began on October 31st in 2017, when, following the rise of the Me Too movement, ministers ordered a review of the Scottish Government's policies and processes for addressing inappropriate conduct. Good start. Why am I saying hop so much?
Hopping. I'm just hopping. It's like what I do in customer service.
Yeah.
Quick side note. Just whenever I'm doing anything, it's always, I'll just pop and get that for you. Like, everything just is just quick and dainty. Like, yeah. I'm just going to pop over here and grab you a knife. Like,
pop.
I hate every time I hate myself. Or nip. Or I swear I said skip before.
I am going to go with skip. Yeah. Or jump. I'm going to jump. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's much more powerful.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to jump to January 2018 when two female staff members made formal complaints to the Scottish Government about Alex Salmond's conduct dating back to when he was First Minister in December 2013.
Christ.
After that, an internal inquiry...
Internal
inquiry.
Oh, God.
It's established.
Yeah.
And an investigating officer appointed. I cannot talk. So let's go to August of the same year. The investigation goes public. A lot of stuff happened in between. So, but it's just a lot of phone calls, really.
That's politics.
Yeah. A lot of phone calls and meetings and blah. So in August, the investigation was made public. Within half an hour of it being made public, Alex Salmond tweeted a statement denying misconduct and calling some allegations, and I quote, patently ridiculous.
It is patent.
Nothing says guilt more. Although Nicola Sturgeon, who is and was at the time First Minister of Scotland, said that there was no legal basis for Alex Salmond to resign from the SNP, which is the Scottish National Party, he did anyway, which again screams guilt to me.
Yeah.
He said it was to avoid an internal division in the party and to remove this line of opposition attack. So we were saying it's political.
Yeah, okay.
For the good of the party.
Okay.
Following on from this, there was two police investigations, and when taken to court, Alex Salmond denied all of them, all the allegations.
Right, okay.
So yeah, keeping the story.
Yeah. He's consistent.
Mm. And then December 14th in 2018, Alex Salmond scored an early legal win in a preliminary court hearing, forcing the government to hand over documents related to its investigation. And in January 8, 2019, 1 week before the full judicial review is due to begin, a hearing is abruptly called at the Court of Session in Edinburgh, where the government concedes defeat.
Wait, so when's that?
January 8th.
So, like, a few days ago.
Yeah.
So they've just...
Very recently.
He's won.
Yeah, they've just said we're not taking it any further.
So he's won. Nice. Cool.
What's truly amazing, rather than saying, okay, I've won, he said, okay, I've won and I want an apology from everyone who made the allegations. So there were two women that put forward allegations. Leslie Evans released a statement apologising to everyone involved for the collapse of the investigation.
Oh, okay.
So okay. Not to him.
Yeah, yeah.
Blaming a single procedural flaw. She says the process itself is still robust and the complaint should be reinvestigated, which is very fair.
Mm-hmm.
Alex Salmond still repeatedly calling for Leslie Evans to consider her position.
Consider her position?
Saying she is responsible for, and I quote, an abject humiliation and a surrender on the part of the government.
Interesting language.
Okay. Yeah, it's really just dramatic.
Mm.
Chill. Stop being such a drama.
So disgusted. It's just dramatic.
It is. Later that day, so this is January 8th still, Nicola Sturgeon makes a statement at Holyrood, which is the seat of the government in Scotland, echoing Leslie Evans' apology and her defence of the process. Oh, and then she says, I was always clear that I had no role in the process. I did not seek to intervene in it at any stage, nor indeed did I feel any pressure to do so. So she hasn't used the word sorry or apology, but it's like she's having to excuse her involvement.
Okay.
And that really is just not why.
No.
So I don't like this whole thing, and I really hope it gets reinvestigated, and I'm going to stay on top of it.
Yeah.
Because Nicola Sturgeon is great, and she shouldn't have to say sorry to anyone.
No, that's so frustrating, really, isn't mm-hmm. it? I mean, he's cocked up, and he's just doing that stupid thing that men in power do. When they do something wrong, so they just spin it on everyone else.
Yeah, there was like, it's just because the investigation, the trial, like, never actually happened.
Mm.
It was a, like, judicial reason that it was stopped.
Mm.
So we actually don't know. We don't have a verdict. It's not been a thorough investigation.
No smoke without fire.
Mm-hmm.
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 Okay.
So yeah, thought that was something that's important to raise, and we'll stay on top of it.
Yeah, you can be our Scottish reporter.
The woman on the ground.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh my god, go to Scotland.
Let's go to Scotland.
Yeah.
Yeah, road trip.
That's something we totally have the time and money to do.
Fine, we can sleep in the car.
Yeah, feasible. That'd be worth the
drive.
Scottish
winter.
Yeah. Oh, God. Great idea.
So, Nina.
It's badass woman from history time. Ooh. Oh, that's what she said.
Mm-mm-mm.
Okay. We really are going global today.
Oh, yeah?
I'm going to take you to 20th century Egypt.
Oh.
And this, I have my Christmas present from Hannah to thank.
Yay!
Because she got me a book. That is all my badass women from history research in a book. So the book is Forgotten Women, the Leaders by Xing Cheng. And I also used a New York Times article, which is actually from a really interesting series that you should also look at for research, called Obituaries, where they're redoing obituaries from all the people that they should have done obituaries for in the past.
Ah, cool.
That's cool. And the article in the New York Times is by David D. Kirkpatrick. So, the lady we're talking about is Doria Shafiq.
I've never heard of this woman.
That's the point. So, she was born in 1908 into a middle-class Egyptian family. Her father, Ahmad Shafiq, was a civil servant whose jobs moved the family among the Nile Delta towns of Tanta, Mansoura and Alexandria, while her mother, Ratiba Nassif, kept house. This was in a time of unique transition for Egypt. Women were expected to marry after receiving short and limited schooling. Doria, however, had the luck and strong will to fight for her education. And just quick, this is one of the things I love about this book that you've got me.
Mm-hmm.
They put luck in there. You know that there's a narrative of, like, they worked really hard so they could do this, and not everyone always acknowledges the luck that comes into it.
Okay.
It's like she was born into a middle-class family,
mm-hmm.
therefore she had the luck and strong will and ability to fight for her education.
Mm-hmm.
After graduating from an elementary school run by French missionaries in Alexandria, Doria Shafiq found that further education was open only to boys. So she studied on her own and completed the official French curricular exams ahead of schedule. The teachers who'd shut her out were forced to acknowledge that she had earned among the top scores in Egypt.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, she did. On the strength of that performance, she appealed for help from Huda el-Sharawi, an aristocrat who had organised elite women to form the Egyptian Feminist Union.
Oh, cool.
Hold the call.
Okay.
For a long time.
I mean, I did hear the elite women bit.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Tapid?
Tepid.
Oh, tepid.
Oh, I feel like we need to say that a lot on this podcast. Like, things are cool, but not quite. Tepid. Okay. To form the Egyptian Feminist Union, which sought social freedoms for women and supported independence from Britain. Unlike Shafiq, Sharawi never pushed for political rights for women, and yet is still celebrated as a national hero.
Okay.
You'll see.
Okay.
You'll see. Sharawi used her status to help elevate Shafiq into government scholarship and to study philosophy at the Sorbonne in Paris. So, aged just 19, she sailed from Alexandria to France, where she dived into her studies at the highly prestigious Sorbonne in Paris. Europe proved to be both a revelation and a shock to her. At the International House in Paris, which was a kind of dormitory for female students, I was picturing St. Trinian's, but I don't think it'll be that. She met women from many other countries, from Martinique to Morocco to Greece, and began to refine her understanding of the torment and prejudice experienced by her gender. It's always a fun revelation to come to, isn't it? She wrote of her time there, "We each had the experience of being misunderstood in our own countries, being intellectually more ambitious than our countrymen." And I got confused by this because the book uses the term countrymen a few times. I didn't know if it literally meant men from the country or country people. And I think they actually mean country people, which is a bit of an oversight in the book, but it makes sense.
So what are we taking it as? Country people?
Country people.
Cool.
Being
not cool, tepid.
It's tepid that,
actually. I see.
So, when she was at the Sorbonne in Paris, she completed the licence libre I'm trying to speak franglais now.
I like it.
The licence d'état, which were not easy. They're two separate degrees. One of them required her to just off the cuff learn Latin, as you do, which she'd never studied before, but she still pulled it off.
Nice.
I was going to say big up then, but I don't say that anymore. Especially not about Latin, God. A few years later, she would successfully defend her doctorate with a thesis. A thesis. Oh, I've tickled Anna.
Poop.
Oh, she defended her thesis. Nope, she defended her doctorate with a thesis that argued the link between women's rights and Islam.
Okay.
Which I'd like to read. But this is just such a fun part of this story that it doesn't really seem to fit anywhere, which is why I love it. She was by no means a bookish recluse. She was back home for the holidays one summer, and she just fancied herself a little bit of fun. So she competed in the Miss Universe heats in Alexandria.
Oh my god!
Of which she said to a French reporter with a little smile, "I wanted to amuse myself a little." Teachers of Islam extolled the virtue of modesty, including the full coverage of women's bodies and hair, and only women of European or Christian heritage had ever entered the Miss Universe contest. Never a Muslim like Shafiq. She saw that as an opportunity. She was the first Egyptian Muslim woman to enter the competition and came second in her heats to a contestant that would later go on to become Miss Universe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She was up there with the big dogs. The Egyptian press, who had previously celebrated her as a national figure of educational achievement, so she's already kind of got herself a big name after this little fun summer activity she did, the press turned nasty and accused her of acting in an un-Islamic fashion. However, Doria saw no contradiction between participating in a beauty contest and her religious or political beliefs. And I put in brackets, big up.
Mm-hmm.
Which, oh, okay.
How many times can we say
That's
it?
All I can say. She said, "In Paris, I had asserted myself in the intellectual sphere. Now I want to assert myself in the feminine sphere." Which we could unpack a bit, but
let's just let it slide.
No, let that go. While studying in Paris, she met and married Nour al-Din Raghay, who was earning a doctorate in commercial law. They had two daughters, Aziza and Jahani. Doria earned her doctorate in 1940, but Egypt's National University refused her a teaching position on the grounds that her beauty and liberal values might somehow damage its scholarly reputation.
Her beauty might damage...
And her liberal values, don't forget them. They're real dangerous, them liberal values.
Mm. Watch out. Jeremy Corbyn's about.
I don't think he was around then. I know he's quite old.
Just liberal values. It makes me think of Jeremy Corbyn.
He's not even that liberal. He's socialist, isn't he?
Yeah. He's not liberal.
No, they're different.
Wow. Okay, I'm sorry.
I'll get you an Andrew Haywood political textbook.
Thank you.
It's real fun.
Mm-hmm.
Been rejected by the university for a teaching position. And then her patron, that woman that had the elite feminist squad, her patron Sharawi, shut Shafiq out as well, excluding her from the elite feminist union because of her middle class background.
What?
As opposed to upper class.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Shady.
Some real elitist elitism, that.
Mm-hmm.
So she's been earning her doctorate. That's where we're at. She moves back to Egypt. Egypt has changed while she was away. Political upheaval was in the air. Though Britain had granted independence to its former protectorate in 1922, there was a simmering discontent with the lingering presence of British imperialism. Doria firmly believed that women had a key part to play in Egypt's struggle for liberation and that feminism would help both genders get there.
Mm-hmm.
Feminism, she wrote in an essay in 1944, in the true sense of the word, this is a brilliant definition. Feminism, in the true sense of the word, is the total comprehension between man and woman, not a perpetual fight between the two sexes. I've never thought of it as a comprehension before, and I like that.
Yeah, I like that too. Also, 1944, that is like way before like the wave of feminist texts of like the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, I know.
Sick.
Yeah.
Nice.
Pioneer,
some may say.
I believe. They call her a rebel? All words escape me then. I was just going to say, like, a woman or something. Oh, okay.
Okay. That's a good try.
I tried. Okay. So, when she was offered a job as the editor-in-chief of La Femme Nouvelle, a French-language magazine associated with Princess Chevikar, the powerful wife of King Fuad, she leaped at the chance to explore these ideas on a large literary platform, but let's not forget the political climate of the country, not very pro-royal at the moment. Taking this position would place her in direct opposition to mainstream political feeling, which saw the monarchy as an out-of-touch relic on the side of the British. Doria's solution to satisfying her critics was to start a more political magazine, this time in Arabic, Bint al-Nil, Daughter of the Nile. As Egyptian society splintered between the Muslim Brotherhood, the communists, and the military, Doria became convinced that the country needed to pass legislation that would allow women to vote and run for office. She argued women must not only be present when laws concerning them are legislated, they must be involved in writing them. By demanding the totality of her rights, particularly her political rights, which are the very basis of all rights, the woman could bring about fundamental changes in society. A lot of rights.
Mm-hmm.
She founded the Bint al-Nil Union, announcing it as a new movement that would bring about emancipation for all Egyptian women, which dedicated itself to educating and organising working women of all classes. The Daughters of the Nile ran literacy classes, an employment agency, mutual aid programmes, a discounted cafeteria, that's my favourite, and cultural events, including theatrical performances for women. Most of all, it agitated for political rights. No one will deliver freedom to the woman except the woman herself, Shafiq later wrote. I decided to fight until the last drop of blood to break the chains shackling the women of my country. So, one of the events that she's probably most famous for was in February 1951, when she gathered a crowd of 1,500 women at a lecture hall at the American University of Cairo for what she billed a feminist congress. But that was just a ruse to fool the police. Shafiq had other plans. Our meeting today is not a congress but a parliament, she said. A true one, that of women. Moments later, she led her army of women as they stormed through the marble gates and onto the floor of Egypt's all-male parliament, the parliament of the other half of the nation, she called it that day. "We are here by the force of our right," Shafiq told a parliamentary leader who tried in vain to stop them. Sorry.
It's okay.
Her demonstrators shut down the legislature for more than 4 hours until the president of its upper chamber pledged to take up their key demands, the right of women to vote and to hold office. He did not, however, address their other demands for pay equity and reforms to the marriage and divorce laws. Over the next few months, Egyptians took to the streets to rage against the monarchy and the government, leading to riots and the 1952 military coup, which overthrew the regime. Doria was ecstatic at the hope of change and turned Bint al-Nahyl into a political party. Women, she thought, would finally carve out their place in the newly declared Egyptian Republic. When Egyptians were campaigning for independence from Britain, Shafiq started a uniformed paramilitary unit of Daughters of the Nile. In January 1952, she led a brigade of its members to surround and shut down a branch of Barclays Bank, deeming it a symbol of British colonial rule.
Fuck you, Barclays!
I want a better overdraft. After the crowd outside turned randy...
Randy?! Is that a copy and paste?
No, that was me.
Oh, all right.
That word wasn't there.
Do you mean rowdy?
I do.
Randy?
Oh my God, the police. After the crowd outside turned randy, the police hauled her away and dispersed them. No, okay. After the crowd outside turned rowdy, the security police hauled her away and dispersed them.
Carry on, just carry on.
I don't know where that came from.
I like it.
I'm sexually satisfied.
Mm-hmm. I'm sexually satisfied.
Oh dear, okay. Shafiq had expected that once the British-backed monarchy was overthrown in 1952, Egypt would see the beginning of a renaissance for women. That's actually super interesting, because the women's wall we were talking about before...
Mm-hmm.
Their sort of demands, one of their like slogans was about maintaining Renaissance ideas for women.
Mm.
Fascinating.
Interesting.
So she was expecting to see the beginning of a Renaissance for women, but nothing changed. Women were still not permitted to vote or participate in a constituent assembly. The next few years were a bitter disappointment. As the military junta cracked down on dissent, the all-male ruling party began to draw up a new constitution without promising any political rights to women. With a group of 8 women, Doria went on hunger strike in protest. I think at this point she was like hospitalised. It was a real intense hunger strike. The reaction in the media was explosive. Doria and her group were hailed as 20th century suffragettes in the international media. 8 days into the hunger strike, and under the glare of the world press, the new government relented. Women would be allowed full constitutional rights in New Egypt. Post-hunger strike, Doria was an international celebrity and embarked on a lecture tour around the world. But when, back in Egypt, President Gamal Abdel Nasser was consolidating his authority and weeding out opposition, Doria, with her newfound links to the West, was an object of suspicion. When she returned, she staged a second hunger strike to protest the encroaching dictatorship of her country. This was to be her final lone act of public protest. She was widely denounced in Egypt, and even her old supporters were terrified of speaking out. Nasser gave women the right to vote, but Doria did not reap the benefits of women's entry in public life. In 1957, Nasser condemned her to house arrest and blacklisted her name in the press.
Oh my God.
Her own political party expelled her, the Daughters of the Nile.
She set that up?
Yep.
Ugh.
And she was branded a traitor to the revolution. Even after the government informally lifted her house arrest, she remained indoors. The betrayal of her allies and countrymen, again, I'm going to say country people, had stung too much. She spent almost 20 years in near total isolation, with only sporadic visits from family to break the solitude. The timeline about this is a bit hazy, but Nasser also jailed Shafiq's husband for several months on suspicion of subversion unrelated to her. Blacklisted in Egypt, he was forced to travel abroad to continue to work. Their separation and divorce in 1967 completed her isolation. So I'm not really sure about the end of her life. The book glosses over it a bit, but I think it was a suicide. She was 66 when she fell from the balcony of her apartment. Her death reawakening public consciousness of this once ubiquitous public figure and made her warning against tyranny all the more resonant. Over her decades in public life, Doria had never yielded and never backed down. It was her own country that failed her. She stayed true to the words she had written when she was just 19. To want and to dare, never hesitate to act when the feeling of injustice revolts us.
Mm.
And that is Doria Shafiq.
Wow. So she got the vote for women in Egypt.
Yeah. And what annoyed me about this the most is I've studied for my undergrad this period of history.
Uh-huh.
I've literally studied the Muslim Brotherhood around that time. There was no mention of her.
Wow.
Like, I was really surprised because I thought maybe at the start of it, I was like, maybe it's more social, so it wasn't as political, and that might be why I don't know anything about it. But
she's very political.
She was very political, and I don't understand
how... She seemed to be a direct enemy of the government, yeah, exactly. According to them. Wow.
All the time I spent learning all the stupid stuff, and I didn't learn about her, but...
Wow. And she was truly, like, one in her own. Like, yeah, certain times she had allies, but they backed down in a lot of ways, and she never did.
She was so resilient. Like, I know she was middle class, but she wasn't the kind of elite that Egypt had. Egypt had the pretty strong elite, the feminist movement, whatever it was called, the Egyptian Feminist Union.
Mm-hmm.
That was really elite women.
Well, I think we've had this discussion before. Like, it shouldn't matter what stage of society you're born into. It's chance. What matters is what you do moving forward.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not like she charged into government and went on hunger strikes and said, give the vote to middle class and upper class women, please. She said, give it to all women and further constitutional rights.
She was a real good feminist.
Mm-hmm.
I really rate her. She's one of the few that I've researched for the podcast where I've not felt, well, you know, when you're kind of wincing at bits, like, this is a little problematic.
Yes, yeah.
Like, there isn't much of that with her, which is crazy given it's, like, early, mid-20th century. Mm. So, yeah.
Wow.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm kind of like, I'm in awe. So, wow. Oh, well, thank you so much.
It's okay.
Really love that. Right, badass woman from history, number 6.
I can't believe 6.
Well, thank you very much.
You're
we
welcome.
Don't have any listener stories.
Yes, we need to talk to you about them, people.
We're probably going to suspend them for a little while.
We're going to put them on the back burner.
Mm-hmm.
We like the idea. And
we love it.
And I love the submissions we've had.
Mm-hmm.
It's something we're definitely going to pick up again in the future.
All right, so from here on out, we aren't going to be reading listener stories each episode, but if you do want to email us, you can, and when we pick them up again, we'll read them out.
It'd be nice to have a backlog when we start again.
Yeah. And of course, you know, corrections, suggestions.
Yeah, we're always open to them. Mm-hmm. No one's really given us any shit yet, which is remarkable.
I know.
Someone, please.
Someone, you literally, you're just letting us, like, do
it. I know,
it.
Yeah. We're getting away with murder here.
No, it's fabulous.
That's the thing.
That's what it is. Uh-huh. So, instead of listening to stories, we're going to have a song.
I like that. That's a good idea.
From Amal, Not What I Thought, and Enjoy.
Enjoy.
See you next time.
Bye. Love you.
You don't know nothing about me. I don't know nothing about you now. I thought it would never be us. Another flame into dark.